My daughter attends the same school as her mother. She goes to Columbine High School. They were both rebels. Yes, that Columbine High School that you've heard of for the tragedy so many years ago. When considering to send my daughter to that school, my wife and I decided we needed to meet with the principal. We were dismayed to find out that Columbine is still the most threatened high school in all of America. That's probably worthy of another podcast altogether, as it taps into any number of psychoses in the United States. This is also, though, largely why it's a rare place, because they have an acting police station on campus. The students know the officers by name. They roam the halls side by side, working together, interacting with each other. Something struck us as we were visiting and interviewing at the campus, and it really has played out throughout my daughter's career there. They took a truly horrific incident, and they did something pretty remarkable with it. They created something pretty good out of it. I don't want to be Pollyannish here. The school has all sorts of problems. My daughter's almost a senior. We've seen the dysfunction at that high school that most high schools face. There are good teachers, there are bad teachers, there are good administrators, there are bad administrators. There are crucial, hard conversations about teaching and learning, poor instruction, poor assessment, and there's plenty of defensiveness to go around and confirmation bias and fallacies throughout the reasoning of the school. But in the midst of a very normal, dysfunctional system, they have largely shut down things like bullying, socio-emotional abuse, psychosocial peer issues. As someone who has studied the whole learner for almost the entirety of my career, I know that as many students drop out or fail out of school because of things like that, it's not just because of grades. And at Columbine, see something, say something really means something to them. Students protect younger classmates from being picked on. And the community of students is more of a community than you would find at most public high schools in the United States. In other words, they didn't let a tragedy go to waste. They used that horrible day to take on a major problem faced by many schools, and they are winning that particular battle. Our guest today knows something about leading through crisis. Today, we're going to hear from Dan Mahoney. Dan is actually on my school's advisory board. He has been one of the leadership studies advisors for almost 10 years. A graduate of West Point, he's also the president of Performance Insights LLC in Spokane. He's been working in the semiconductor industry for years. It's really been fantastic getting to know Dan during my first year as dean, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to our program and to introduce him to our listeners. Welcome, Dan.
At Horizon Credit Union, community is who we serve, and helping you grow is our goal. Your path is our purpose, and together we can make a positive impact. Whether you're ready for a checking account, a home loan, or a team that cares about your dreams, doing business here does good in the community. Discover the difference and open your account today, or find a branch near you at hzcu.org. Horizon Credit Union is an equal housing opportunity lender insured by NCUA.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
I really am so grateful that you're with us. I wonder if you might bolster that little intro I gave of you with just some other things that you think our audience might like to hear about you.
You bet. I would say that my whole leadership journey started as a cadet at West Point, which you alluded to. And it gave me a unique perspective on leadership for somebody as young as I was. The perspective in the late 70s, when I was a cadet, with every officer and professor having had combat leadership experience in Vietnam, was about the importance of leadership. And it wasn't uncommon, if you made a mistake, to be told, "Cadet, you just got your platoon wiped out." So the life or death significance of leadership decisions was rammed home to me very early in my career. And then that developed throughout the rest of my military career, where we were told that a commander is responsible for all that their unit does or fails to do, that the maximum effective range of an excuse is 0 meters, and that no army has bad soldiers, just bad leaders. So the importance and the significance of leadership in the outcomes of an organization was part of my earliest programming as a leader. And then I extended that into my semiconductor industry career, which we can talk about next.
You know, it's probably not a coincidence that, you know, Simon Sinek and Brené Brown and Liz Wiseman, they talk about the importance of leadership in the military, because it's such an interesting microscope, right? You just have this interesting little ecosystem that really puts on display what happens when bad leadership takes over.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. You got to experience that firsthand. That's fantastic.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me start with the question that I ask all of our guests. I said in the opening podcast that my favorite term associated with leadership is the word intentional. I'm curious, when you think of leadership, what word do you like to associate with that?
Well, Jeff, I might approach this a little differently than others. My term is accountable. That's what it is to me. That's not necessarily how you do it.
Right.
There are many aspects of how you can be a good leader, many elements of leadership that we could talk about. But to me, what it is accountability. Accountability for the results of the organization that you lead. Going back to that military program, a commander is responsible for all that their unit does or fails to do. So that's not necessarily how you lead, but accountability to me is what leadership is all about. And it requires many other characteristics and traits to be fully accountable and authentically accountable.
So let's pick that apart just for a second, Dan. When you go into a situation where you are in a position of authority and you've got that sort of formal leadership role, how do you infuse accountability either for yourself or for the folks that you're working with? What does that look like? What's something tangible that somebody might be able to stick to and say, hey, I can do that?
I think that the key to establishing accountability as the leader throughout an organization is to have everybody aligned around a common objective, a clearly articulated objective that people buy into. And that's a whole nother story, as you probably know. And it involves bringing out the best in everybody in an organization to accomplish that goal. I never want my organization limited by what I know. I want it limited by the cumulative knowledge of everybody in the organization. And when you share a common vision and you incentivize everybody in positive ways around progress in achieving that common vision, accountability is a natural result. And I think a third element there is not looking to blame when things go wrong, but looking to learn when things go wrong and looking at problems and mistakes as learning opportunities. That also makes it easier to establish accountability because people are not afraid to acknowledge mistakes in that kind of a culture.
You know, I'm going back and rereading the Leadership Challenge, which I know has some roots in our school, but everything that you're talking about there in the five components that Posner and Kuzis talk about, accountability, the way that groups come together, that leaders form teams, and then how that knowledge goes up and down the ladder really is a crucial component of good leadership. Did you experience that in the military, or was that something that you felt like you had to maybe tweak or change a little bit when you got out?
You know, Jeff, what I learned about leadership in the military harmonized perfectly with the needs of leadership in the business world. When you're a junior officer, you know very little about the specific area that you're serving in. West Point is a college education. It doesn't make you a military expert yet. You're surrounded by NCOs, non-commissioned officers, who you technically outrank, but who know far more about the field artillery or the armor or the infantry branch than you do. And if you do not learn quickly and early to rely on them to draw out their knowledge and their support in the execution of your mission, you are certain to fail. And so being a junior military officer teaches you to be humble because you don't know as much as most of the people around you initially. And that same principle served me incredibly well in the business world.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I want to now look at another side of that coin. I know that you obviously are affiliated with Gonzaga, as I described in the introduction. You also are connected to Whitworth University, another Spokane university that has religious affiliations. My sister graduated from Whitworth, so I know that. Mm-hmm. You are obviously surrounded by conversations regularly of ethical leadership, ethical decision-making. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe describe to our listeners what that means to you in your world?
I would like to address that question on two levels. One is on the interpersonal level. People will not follow somebody they don't trust. Mm. People will not follow somebody who they think has more interest in their own success than in the success of the team. And so trust is essential in becoming a good leader to individuals. If you are dishonest and you're dealing with people internally or externally, you're giving permission to everybody around you to do the same thing. You're setting an example that some people will follow, and you'll be creating a culture of dishonesty. The other perspective is the external perspective. In the business world, customers buy from people who they know, mm-hmm. like, and trust.
Right.
And if you do not have the trust of your customers and other stakeholders within your ecosystem, partners and suppliers, as well as employees, you cannot establish a sustainable competitive advantage. And so internally, trust is essential. Externally, trust is essential. And the way to establish both elements of trust, both forms of trust, is through continuous, consistent ethical decision making.
I would encourage, if our listeners haven't seen it, I've alluded to it, I think, in two different podcasts. Cynic has a fantastic little 3-minute video around the military. I think he's talking about the SEALs and productivity versus trust and how they pick leaders who they trust more than those that are just productive all the time. So I think it's exactly what you're talking about.
Great point.
So with that said, with all of your background that really revolves around the leadership conversation and the ethical notions of leadership, I'd like to talk specifically about really what is at the heart of today's podcast. I'd like you to talk about a place where those ethics and leadership really came into intersection. Can you tell us about what happened in 2011 when you were CEO? Is it pronounced Renesas?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Renesas Electronics America. I'd like the audience to hear what happened that year that was so pivotal in your outlook on leadership.
Sure. In March of 2011, the Great East Japan earthquake occurred. It was one of the largest earthquakes to hit a developed urbanized country in history.
Yeah.
And it killed 20,000 people, which is a very tragic element of the earthquake. It also knocked offline my company's largest chip manufacturing facility in central Japan in a town called Naka. And what was significant about this, Jeff, is the fact that the chips we made there were not commodities. Mm-hmm. When we couldn't supply these particular devices, they were called microcontrollers. It's not like a customer could go buy the same thing from Samsung.
Right.
Or Intel. Or Texas Instruments. They could not buy it from anybody else. Their whole system was designed around the architecture of this chip. So it was proprietary. And it looked like our factory was going to be offline for almost a year. And that meant that proprietary devices supporting thousands of customers throughout the world in dozens of different industries, from automotive to mobile communications to networking to appliances, white goods, and other things like that. Those customers were looking at a one-year delay in shipping their products or the need to completely redesign the product around a different chip, which Wow. could take almost a year as well. So we were looking at an existential crisis for our customers and obviously for our own company. And this resulted in pressure to make decisions that had very significant ethical implications. And before I go into that, I'll stop and see if you want to clarify anything that I've just said about the crisis itself.
Well, I've read the story in a couple of different places. You've blogged about it, and if the audience is so inclined, I would encourage you to go read some of those blogs that Dan has posted on LinkedIn. They're really powerful. But I was, it just struck me as I was going through that and then just looking up some facts around the earthquake. You're dealing with this as a business in the midst of chaos in Japan. Mm-hmm. So you're also having to try to deal with local infrastructure issues that are really at odds with you. Let's just for a second, let's talk about that. What did you guys do in your sort of leadership meetings and your conversations as you were, and I know you have great esteem for the person who is sort of boots on the ground and leading the company over there. Mm-hmm. What did you all do to work with the local people who are in the midst of their own crisis that many of them could have cared less about your business? They were just dealing with emergent problems. How'd you guys handle that?
I would say the secret to the approach that we took was transparency. Mm. From the very beginning, Jeff, we were honest with every stakeholder, the residents of the area, the employees of the company, the suppliers, the bankers, the investors, the partners of the company, as well as the customers. So everybody knew the stakes. Everybody knew exactly where we stood and what the impact of this lack of chip supply was going to be on industries throughout the world. And one thing that helped overcome this problem is that we were the largest supplier to the Japanese automotive industry, which represents 10% of their GDP, 10%. And so the Japanese government got involved and made it an all of government effort to help restore production in the factory. And that ultimately resulted in a 12-month projected recovery cycle being telescoped back down to 4 months. But still, that wasn't known at the beginning. And the other element of this that is really significant from an ethical perspective is that major customers asked us to support them first.
Brilliant.
At the expense of smaller customers. And these customers, the large customers, were the most important part of our business. And they said, if you support us first, you can support us completely. Cut the other smaller customers off. And if you do, we'll continue to do business with you. If you don't, we won't. And the management team made a decision to treat every customer the same. So our supply of these proprietary chips was cut in half. Everybody got half of what they were getting before, whatever it was. The pie got smaller, but nobody got a smaller share of the pie. And while that was being implemented, we allowed people to come over and visit the factory, watch us recover, and also confirm the allocations that we had promised were being honored. And so this form of honesty built on top of what I would call justice for everybody, fairness and equity for everybody, then combined with just a four-month interruption of supply, resulted in an absolutely miraculous outcome. Customers who said they would never do business with us again ended up coming back and saying, you are our most trusted supplier.
So you were able to take that unethical request and really turn it into a powerful ethical model.
Yes.
That really changed your trajectory. That's amazing.
And it branded the company differently, Jeff. People started to look at the company not only as technically competent, which we were a $10 billion company, but they also started to look at us as a true partner and as somebody that they could trust through thick and thin. And there's one other dimension of this I'd like to mention if I have a minute. And that is the fact that this experience reinforced the point that you never give up, even when a situation seems hopeless. Mm-hmm. We thought we were going to be out of business. We didn't think we could survive a year without this revenue. In the end, it took 4 months to recover the revenue. And in the meantime, we kept customers alive by reallocating supply chain inventory. Yeah. One customer would have surplus on one device and a shortage of another. We would match them up with customers with the opposite situation. So everybody was able to cross level inventory, and we had other warehouse inventory and distributor inventory that we could allocate according to critical needs. And in the end, almost no customer lost revenue during that 4 month period of time. And there's an interesting parallel to that. British Airways 747 flight 009 in 1982 lost all four engines over the Indian Ocean. due to volcanic ash that it had ingested. The pilots never stopped trying to restart the engines. And at 10,000 feet, one of them restarted and then another one restarted. If they had given up, they would have crashed. We had the same attitude. We simply never gave up. And when the miracle happened, we were still alive to receive it.
That tenacity and grit paid off. That's brilliant. So, okay. So I know, again, from some of the articles that you've written and some of the conversations we've had, you also had other leaders who you really have grown a tremendous amount of respect for, and you write about them so nicely. I'm really sorry. I don't want to butcher his name. I know you speak about, is it Yasushi Akayo? Is that how you pronounce it?
Akao is the last name. Yes. Uh-huh.
Tell us a little bit about what you found in working with him.
What I found in working with him was total unselfish humility and servant leadership. His goal was to make sure that when this crisis was over, that we all had our reputation for integrity and ethical leadership intact. He wasn't even sure the company would survive. Yeah. But he said, if it doesn't, we're still going to be in the industry. We want people to trust us. And so his mantra was, let's do the right thing, do it to the best of our ability, and then trust the results, whatever they are.
So I want to ask one last question before we bring our student in, Dan. You speak about this a lot. I know you give keynotes on this and presentations and workshops. Mm-hmm. When you talk with audiences who weren't there and who really you're trying to really give them a sense of just how significant this was in so many ways, what do you usually try to leave folks with when you're talking about this to audiences of leaders or workers or whatever that might look like? What's the big aha you try to leave people with?
Jeff, the fundamental takeaway for me is that you don't decide in the middle of a crisis that you're going to be ethical. You decide that before the crisis. You decide that this is how we are, this is how we operate, and you operate this way in good times and bad. And then when the crisis hits, you just continue operating according to those values and those norms. You don't change colors, you don't change stripes just because a crisis hits. So you have to make this an enduring, continuous commitment in order for it to be in effect when you really need it the most.
What a fantastic message. And so, so timely. I think, in fact, we're going to see what you just described on display both directions in the coming year with all the political stuff going on. So what a lovely end cap. Thank you for that.
Sure.
I'd like to bring in one of the School of Leadership Studies students at this point, just as we do on these podcasts. We're going to hear from a student in terms of someone who is reviewing and studying leadership in all of its different sort of capacities and forms. And we're going to try to have a conversation between someone who has been in these ethical leader dilemmas with someone who is an emerging leader in her own right. So I'm happy to introduce to you Melinda Cadwallader. Did I say that right, Melinda?
Cadwallader. Yeah,
it's a long one. Sorry. Apologize. Melinda and I discovered at the beginning of this, we have a nice connection with Colorado. So go Coloradans. I'm so proud to say she's going to be graduating from the School of Leadership Studies, getting her master's this May. Melinda has a wealth of industry experience as well. She comes into this with her own past and background of leadership elements. And I'm sure that some of that will pop out as we go. Welcome, Melinda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Why don't you tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself?
I come into academics with 20 years of experience in leadership within the beauty and cosmetics industry. Predominantly the trades education, private owned franchised schools, directing, leading, educating, facilitating, all of those aspects. And after 20 years, I needed to keep going in my life. And that kind of glass ceiling effect took place. And I decided it was time for education. So 2017, I have been going full force got my associate's, bachelor's. Now here I am at Gonzaga graduating with my master's. And of course, on to PhD eventually. But I love it. It's, I feel like I'm flourishing like I never have. Being midlife, being a wife and mother, it's enhanced my life and my own humanity in so many ways. Yeah, I love it.
Beautiful. Oh, I love the richness of, you're going to come at this from so many angles. So let's dive in. You got to hear the opening part of the conversation. I'm curious, what does that bring to mind for you from your studies, from your world, your life, your context, your experience? What are you thinking about now?
Yeah, so several different things Mr. Mahoney, Dan, spoke about, especially the interpersonal elements of trust. It brings me to Edelman, global consultant Edelman Group. They have something called a trust barometer, where they really discuss business as an opportunity to be leaders in the social world of trust, building trust. Right now we have a torn social fabric, there's mistrust in government, and he really positions businesses as those leaders to build trust in society. And so hearing Dan talk about that was absolutely aligned with that. It's a great responsibility. And to hear leaders speak of it with such pride and dignity of the work they do, that's encouraging for me.
Right. Dan, talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't think there's anything more important to leadership than integrity and trust. And they go hand in hand. People trust you because you have integrity. And there's a number of different ways of looking at that, but I think it's more than just not telling lies. It's actually being transparent as much as the situation will allow. You obviously don't reveal confidential personal information, but you're not just avoiding lies. You're transparent and you're telling people as much as they need to know, as much as you're able to tell them. And another element of integrity to me is caring just as much about the other person and about the organization as you do about yourself. I believe leaders are successful when their organizations are, not when they focus on their own success.
That resonate, Melinda?
Absolutely.
What else are you thinking? I know I cut you off there just a little bit.
No, I think the concept of ecosystem is also very important to consider. Dan spoke about the interpersonal efforts of trust building and transparency. And I think that really can be foundational to intrapersonal. And that's where it grows and develops. It's within the person themselves. So leadership first being that intrapersonal, your self-communication, uh-huh. your self-growth, your faith, your humanity. And then from that place being having your pillars that build your intrapersonal skills, being able to relate those and express those out in the world. I feel like that's a very, what I call a matriarchal leadership, because it's from deep within, it's intuitive, and it's how you express yourself and the strengths that you have with others and in your community and globally.
Well said. Very well said, Melinda.
So Dan, that I think probably resonates with anyone who's listening right now that's also a parent. I don't think that it should go by the wayside that how you work effectively with kids, and I realize not every parent works effectively with their kids, but I think most are trying to. There's a lot of commonalities here, aren't there, with regard to trust and transparency in that leadership context. When some of those things that I think for years were assumed not to have a place in the business world, we now know better. We now know that those things really do have a place in good ethical leadership frameworks. Does that resonate with you?
It certainly does. I say that to both of you. And I think one reminder of that to me is the fact that your kids see you as you really are. Really, they see you unvarnished and how you treat everybody. And even if you're not lying to them or being unethical to them, if they see you do that to someone else, they will still lose respect for you. And when your employees in an organization see you cutting corners with a customer or with a supplier or with a partner, even though you may not have done that with them personally, they suddenly wonder when that will happen to them.
Right. Yeah. So Melinda, for excellent tea up there, let me throw it back to you now from the question perspective. What questions do you have for Dan based on what we've talked about so far?
So what I've seen and what I experience and especially having children who are working now, they're working in companies with adult leaders, there is a disconnect in that ecosystem of caring for the employee versus caring for the consumer and who comes first. So when you talk about an ethical framework internally within the organization, how do you find balance for that? Where the same, I mean, especially with education, we can evaluate our students to make sure that they're getting their needs met and that they are getting the service and value that they have expected. But how do we bridge that within an organization where we're exuding the same care and concern for the people that are helping us move along in this shared vision and the shared mission that we have ethically?
That's a very powerful question. And I'm going to have to go back to the way I wrapped up the introductory session with Jeff. You do this, Melinda, by not making it a last minute decision. You do this by integrating it into who you are as a leader. I faced enormous temptations in my career to do the wrong thing. There was a year when dynamic random access memory prices fell by 90% due to oversupply. There were a number of my peers convicted of price fixing by the DOJ several years later. There was temptation to do that. But I went into that crisis knowing that's not how I tick. I was offered large sums of money to be a consultant on the industry to firms that were really just trying to collect proprietary, non-public information for insider trading purposes. They didn't say that, but I smelled it. I suspected it, and I stayed away from it. And it's not something I might have made the right decision on in the heat of the moment. You have to decide who you are up front and then act that way. And then we're all human. We make mistakes, but when we do, we own them. We acknowledge them. We confess them to our peers and say, this is what I just learned.
Dan, let me double down on that question. Let me take it in a little different direction. I've been a part of a couple of startups in my lifetime, and I know that venture capitalists are just trying to, you know, they're really blood from a stone comes to mind. They're trying to eat every penny out of typically that CEO who had the idea in the first place, which is why you end up seeing, you know, those sort of type A people just doing all the work, working 80 hours a week, trying to make that, you know, trying to triple their earnings 3 years in a row, all the crazy stuff. What responsibility do leaders have to their employees? Because I see that context, and I don't see a lot of those entrepreneurial startup type CEOs really necessarily knowing how to take care of their employees. And that's not even necessarily their first priority. Mm-hmm. But as Melinda's question really asks, I think it's important to think about this in terms of how we take care of our people. What advice would you give to folks in that sort of context?
I led a startup at the end of my career for 4 years, Jeff.
Yeah.
And most people do the startup first. I did it last. And what I learned in that experience in terms of taking care of people is that you can't change some of the realities of the startup world. The fact that you're trying to create something from nothing, that you're always running on fumes financially. So what you owe them is honesty. We have a 10% chance of success here. If we are very successful, these are the potential rewards. If we're moderately successful, these are the more likely rewards. But it's possible that we all walk away from this in 2 or 3 years with nothing. And if you're not comfortable with that calculus, then you should find a more secure job. Honesty. It's always what we owe our people is honesty.
Yeah. Melinda, as you are going through your studies, and you even mentioned Edelman before, that trust component, you're probably hearing over and over again, coming into culture, it comes into productivity, it comes into satisfaction, and all the different things that we measure today, at least, in terms of worker productivity and worker, you know, retention, those sorts of things. How does that play with you?
I think it all comes back to values, being clear on knowing what your values are and then stating them and then abiding by them publicly so people can see. When Dan was speaking about, yes, your children see you, there is an old poem that states, children learn what they live, mm-hmm. not what you tell them. Right. So you can, and I remember hearing this from a woman at my church years ago, like, how do we teach our children? Should I do Bible studies every morning with my kids? And she was like, no, just live your values, just live them. And they'll see them every day and they'll adopt them and they will adapt to them and they will find themselves doing them and following those same value systems because it will come so naturally, they won't have to think about it. So even just that as leadership too, just being an upholder of your own values, holding yourself accountable. I think that's where we're at and what's needed too today.
Yeah, actions speak louder than words, don't they, Melinda? Absolutely. And a poster on the wall with your values and your mission doesn't carry as much weight as the way you behave.
Mm-hmm. What did you do in terms of value proposition, Dan, in all of your orgs that you've been a part of? It sounds like you were very values driven and very values based. Mm-hmm. How did you, I've had leaders before who said, you know, we're going to speak our mission at the beginning of every meeting just to remind ourselves why we're doing this, how we're doing this. Mm-hmm. What mechanics did you put in place to really promote a values driven organization in the places that you've been?
So a tool that I used very successfully that I recommend to any leader is a combination of two communications methods. One is I did a monthly update, a monthly newsletter to all employees, just sharing what was on my mind and always inviting feedback, either public or private feedback, and never trying to sugarcoat bad news. But also, you know, pointing out things that we should feel good about. And then I reinforced that with quarterly company meetings. And since it was a company that was spread around the country, sometimes it was in groups, in series of group meetings. But I just opened up the discussion to hear what was on people's minds. And just being around them, giving them an opportunity to share what their fears, concerns, and doubts and questions were. And those two vehicles provided incredible resiliency when the storms hit. So those are the two tools that I used.
Melinda, as you're going through your studies, again, let me ask, is this aligning with some of the things that you're talking through in your coursework?
Absolutely. I'm in communications leadership. So for me, even going back to the anthropologist, Edward Hall, speaking about culture, culture's the silent language. So it's how we behave based on what we think and what we consume and how we want to live. And so, again, that culture, it's communications on not just the verbal and not just posted on the wall, but also mm-hmm. our nonverbal, how we behave with people, our attitudes and demeanors. Like, there's so many avenues of communication leadership that we can choose to reinforce our values and represent them in ways that are practical and also provide opportunity for people to align them in ways that are more intuitive to them as a human being. They can adopt them in different ways, but we're all still adopting the same common core principles.
I love those perspectives, Melinda. I often think of values as how people behave in the absence of specific guidance.
Yeah, your ethics are what show in the dark, right?
Yeah. When nobody's looking, how do you behave?
That's right. So, Melinda, we've got time for one more question before we start to wrap things up. So I wanted to give you the opportunity for that.
My final question is, I know you said your word was intentional, Mr. Borden, as far as growing a capacity for leadership. So, Dan, what would you say would be your one word of when you think of leadership or growing a capacity for leadership that you would think that graduate students or undergrads should either investigate or get curious about? What is one word that you would align with that?
Yeah, and again, I divide this question into two parts. What leadership is to me is accountability. How you do it, how you achieve it, it's based on trust, integrity, humility, unselfishness, the ability to bring the most out of everybody and to give them credit for what they do, to multiply their talents. That's the how. But the what is, I'm responsible for this. And there are no excuses that are going to work.
That's lovely, Dan. I want to give you both sort of one final word here as we close this wonderful podcast. So Melinda, let me ask you, final thoughts before we say goodbye to the audience.
I think it's amazing what Daniel explained about what I see as the balance between infrastructure and architecture, where the infrastructure is the trust. It's the trust building, it's integrity. And that is what contributes to a balance of strong architecture, which is how we behave out in the world. So I'd love to hear how these balance each other out and how we are individually responsible for our own infrastructure so that when we come together with other people, we are building an architecture that's supportive of a healthy, thriving economy and society.
Yeah, life really is just a big scale, isn't it? Trying to balance both sides of that scale. Dan, love to hear your final thoughts on today's conversation.
You know, one final thought I'll share with you all is that almost everybody I've worked with was a capable person who wanted to do a good job. And that if there were performance issues, the best way to understand it was through questions, to understand what my contribution to those problems might be, to learn more about the situation from other people's perspective. And these problems are usually fixable. I could count on one hand the number of people over 30 years that truly didn't belong in my organization. Most of the people were excellent people who were trying, and with enough communication and enough support and enough empathy, they were able to excel.
Oh, that makes me think of my dad, who I actually interviewed in a podcast a couple months ago. One of his life lessons was when a senior leader to him came up and said, you know, and my dad's a pastor. He said, you know why people struggle to follow you is because it sounds like you think we're going to lose. Whereas this particular senior pastor who was loved by everyone, people thought when they got done listening to him, man, we're going to do this. We're going to win. We're going to get ahead. So yep. That's lovely, Dan. Thank you. Well, to our listening audience, thank you so much. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Again, congrats to Melinda. This May should be quite the celebration for you.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I hope it's wonderful. So glad you're going to graduate with, I'm anxious to hand you your diploma. I'll put it that way. And Dan Mahoney, thank you so much for being here today and sharing with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure, Jeff. And I am really grateful for how Gonzaga reflects ethics in leadership.
Very good. Well, to everyone, we will talk to you next time. Good luck and good leading.